I'll consider this all for some reason, it's time to relax, I think, Jen, probably.
You were the prime example.
Apparently.
I see you're right here, occupying this volume of space, and therefore.
Here we go. Collapse exists, QED.
Okay, I'm talking about collapse models, and last time I spoke to you about the gambler's ruin game as a very exact analogy to collapse, the wave function collapse, and I showed you that, or a little proof for Homer, both of those statements are true, that indeed that these equations, an equation that I've written over here, describes wave function collapse when the Hamiltonian vanishes, so that the collapse isn't competing with the Hamiltonian evolution. The wave function collapses to eigenstates of the operator capital A with the probabilities given by quantum mechanics' standard collapse rule, namely that the if the wave function initially is equal to the sum of alpha n a sub n, this is the magnitude of this squared is the probability that the wave function collapses to this state. That is the state vector after a long enough time. It's just proportional to that. And the CSL, these two statements, the wave function evolution equation, which tells you how the wave function is moving, and you can put in any function W of t that you like in here of up to white noise class, and the probability rule, which says what's the probability that nature actually chooses such a W. So those two equations, that's the theory, that's the works, that's all there is. And then you just go ahead and calculate. Except this is not a complete theory because I haven't yet told you what A is. It's not a physical theory, I have to make a physical choice of what A is, and in a moment I'm going to remind you what that is, yes.
Just to be fair, that W is like a fluctuating field.
It's a fluctuating field.
So the probability, since I'm willing, I don't
take that form. That's right. It'll take its probability. This is a function of W. When you take the scalar product of this state vector with itself, this is a function of W for all times between 0 and time t. So, this dW is equal to the product. You can then, the way to actually think of this in terms of calculational purposes, is to think of this integral as a sum. In other words, dt, make the t's t sub j's a whole bunch of discrete times, and then each of those w's is completely independent of every other w. So that's what makes this a white noise class, that you can have a function which goes, let's say, has a value here at one time and has a value over there at another time, and it's very, very discontinuous kind of behavior. Each W can take any value you like, and this dW is the product over all those TJs of dWj divided by the square root of 2 pi lambda over the infinitesimal amount dt. So you simply integrate over each one of those W's when you want to find out. So this is a function of, once you calculate this and then you discretize, this is a function of the W's at every single one of those times, and you just integrate over each of them separately. Okay, thanks for asking. Although we will actually, for most of the calculations I'm going to do today, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to find some various, calculate the various consequences of the full-blown CSL collapse model. And for simplicity, all of those will have the Hamiltonian set equal to 0. So we could just forget the Hamiltonian, nonetheless, to be general as possible. And to make the formula as simple as possible, it's easier to work in what's called the interaction picture, which is the Schrodinger picture, the state vector revolves and the operators don't change with time at all. Here, the operators change with time, and the state vector only interacts because of the interaction. In this case, it's the collapse interaction. So if there was no collapse interaction, the state vector simply would not evolve, and that's often what's called the Heisenberg picture. The simple relationship is the unitary transformation relationship between the interaction picture, and I have no superscript here because that's what I'll be working with in the Schrodinger picture. This is what it is. And when you multiply this by e to the iht, carry out the calculation, you find what happens is that the h disappears from here, but this a, which is time independent, appears over here. The time dependence gets thrown onto the operator, a, And that operator, as a function of time, is just a unitary transformer of that. And it's just a simpler picture to use. I thought it was look more elegant than that. Generalization of this, which is what we're going to be using, is if there are many A's, and I'll put a superscript R on them here, then what essentially one has is that every single separate A is responsible for helping the collapse along. So the more different that the eigenstates of the joint operators, these A's are all supposed to commute with each other, so you can make an eigenstate, which is a joint eigenstate of all of them, that every single one of them helps the collapse go if the states are different in eigenvalues. And so this is the simple generalization. All that is involved here is you just have one fluctuating field per A. So there's you have a bunch of fluctuating fields, each one working with a particular operator to make collapse because of the difference of eigenvalues for that particular operator. Okay? Now, I would like to, because our calculations that we're going to make are going to be for the ensemble, now that we've seen collapse takes place, okay, when you actually do calculations, they are going to be calculations with regard to certain experiments. And experiments, you do repeated experiments to see what the results are. And for the ensemble of experiments, you want to talk about the ensemble of collapses. We now know collapse is taking place, and we want to see what the predictions of the theory are for the complete ensemble of collapses. And for that, we want the density matrix. And so I want to go over with you how we obtain the density matrix for this particular example. And then it'll be obvious what it is for this, and then finally it'll be obvious what it is for the full-blown CSL. The way you calculate the density matrix is you take the probability of a W, which is this. So this dW is an infinitesimal. It means W, each of the W's, well, there's only one W here. That W value is between some numerical value and a little tiny difference. So this is just, I wrote it up there, what the dW is. Multiplied by the pure states, which are normalized. And these states that I've written that equation for are not normalized states. You have to divide by the square norm in order that this is just the scalar product of this with that, so that these states are normalized. And the nice thing about this is that the square norm happens to be this probability over here. So these two collapse, these two cancel, and you're simply left with this simple expression for the density matrix. And these are integrals you can do, so let's do them. So I'm just going to substitute in for the state vector right there. And here is the psi tw over here. And can't forget the time ordering, because A depends upon time. You have to remember the time ordering, so that it's the earlier. Just think of this as a product of exponentials. With time 0 here, then time delta t there, then time 2 delta t there, all the way up to time t. That's what the time ordering means. And when you take the Hermitian conjugate, then these have to be time reverse ordered. That is, the exponential with time 0 is here, time delta t there, so forth and so that way. Okay, so this is what you have to do. And then when you start to do the integral, you want to integrate over each of these w's, each of the discrete w's. And you iterate over a bunch of them. Let me just do one of them. You'll have something in the middle here, presumably all the previous integrals that you've done from time 0, time delta t, 2 delta t, et cetera, on up to some time in the middle. And that's all the stuff over here. And then one of these terms is this times the dt times the w associated with that time minus 2 lambda a associated with that time. And this is the corresponding to that time is so the same w on the other side is over here. And that's an integral that you know how to do because we had homework problem 1. And you know that what the result of that integral is the differences of the mean values of this minus this squared and divided by the sum of the two Gaussian with the difference of those two squared divided by the sum of the two variances down here, but there's a little tiny complication here, which is that these A's are on the left of whatever is in the middle over here, and these A's are on the right. And so if I don't distinguish between them, I'm going to get all mixed up, and who knows what to do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a subscript L over here and a subscript R over here. And then I'm free to perform the integral, because when I'm all done with the integral, all I have to remember is that if I was to, for example, expand this into some kind of power series, all the ALs go to the left, and all the ARs go to the right, what's ever there. And so you do the integral, this thing squared minus this thing squared, or AL minus AR squared times 4 lambda squared. You divide it by the sum of the two, which is 8 lambda, and all the constants work out correctly. And this is what you get from an integral from just one of those times. And then you have to have the product for all the times, and this is what you end up with, a very simple expression for the density matrix. And what actually will be most useful to us is not this expression so much, but the time derivative of the density matrix. And because this is time ordered, sorry, there should be a time ordering operation over here. In addition to the left and right, they're time ordered on the left and time reverse ordered on the right. You have to remember that. You then can take the time derivative of this, and then this is what you get. And you don't need, because when you take the derivative of this with respect to t, you just get this evaluated at the time t. You don't need to worry about left and right. Well, so you do have to worry about left and right, but this is what it comes down to. It's the same time. These operations depend upon the time, and it becomes just the double commutator of a with rho. And if you write it out in detail, the double commutator is given by this expression. Okay. So it should be rho of t everywhere. So we now have the basic tool here, which is this equation down here, to work with as the fundamental equation that we have to solve to find how the ensemble of state vectors behaves in any given circumstance. Now, this isn't yet CSL heavy, so to speak. This is CSL light. The first step in making it CSL heavy is to work with many A's, so that each of these would be a WR, AR, ARs here, and these would be summed over all Rs. And then this result here would be the sum of terms from every single, because all of the W's associated with these are all different. So this would be the sum of all Rs. And finally, this is what you get if you have many Rs. And this would be summed over all Rs. So in other words, the actual proposal we're going to make is going to have many mutually commuting operators cooperating to collapse the state vector. And what are those operators? Here's where the physical choice is made. And if you want to make another choice, great. You go ahead and put it in, and you see what the consequences are, see if it frees the experiment or not. The choice I'm going to make is mass density at a point of space. Essentially, that's what it is. I'll be more careful in a moment. That is, each of these A's, these R indices, is going to correspond to a point of space. And what A is actually going to be is proportional, up to a constant, in other words, the mass density in a sphere of a certain radius, and that radius is called little a, the sphere of radius A around the point x. So those are commuting operators. And that's what the indices are. They're x indices, but they represent physically the mass density in a sphere around the point x. And the reason is that what the equation is going to look for then is if you have a superposition of something here plus something there, the mass density for the state where the object is here, its distribution in space, is quite different from the mass density distribution for an object that's over here. After all, the object that's over here, it has a high mass density in this region and zero mass density over there. Whereas this object, well, it's the same object over here, has high mass density over here and zero mass density over there. So they differ in the mass density at different regions of space, and that will make the collapse process go to one or the other of these states. That's the idea. And we'll actually do some calculations and see how that works, what the collapse rate is and all that. So the actual proposal here is, it's exactly the state vector evolution is exactly the one that's over here, the many A's state vector evolution. where this sum is an integral over the x values, and rather than put a superscript x here, I put it inside the argument. So for each point, think of that as a sum over all x's, each w of x minus 2 lambda a of x. And what is a? Okay. These equations here have a of t, which means that the unitary transformation. But the crucial thing here is what's a is not in the interaction picture, but just what is a. This is the mass density operator. And to make this dimensionless, not quite dimensionless, this over here. But this is divided by the mass of a proton. And we'll see that that makes the lambda that we're going to talk about the collapse rate of a proton. I have to choose something to normalize this to. But forgetting this, this is the mass density times this Gaussian. Now, what is this? This is something that, this is A of x. And this is something which is essentially 1, very close to 1, when z is close to x. What do I mean close? I mean roughly within the radius A, within distance A, little a, of x. So it's the mass, you can think of this as being essentially 1 for z in the sphere of radius A, but then it decays quite rapidly, as a Gaussian does, when this difference squared is larger than A. So if you have a point here, which is x, you're integrating the mass density over a sphere of radius A, rather than making this something which is 1 or 0, a Gaussian is a smoother kind of function, and that's what's there. But you should think of it as that's the way it is. It's the mass density inside a sphere, and then there's this numerical factors over here. The mass density operator I don't know if you're familiar with creation annihilation operators for particles, but you won't need it that much, but it's the mass density operator. This is the annihilation operator for a particle of type alpha. For example, alpha would be an electron, or a proton, or a neutron, or a pion, or anything you like, and this is the creation operator for it. So this combined is the number density, the number per unit volume operator of at point z, and the mass. What makes it a mass density operator is you multiply it by the mass of that particle, and you sum it over all the different types of particles you have, so you have the total mass density operator here. The probability rule is exactly the same as it's always been, except you now have W's labeled by X as well as T. So you then discretize, if you want to do your calculation space and time, you make this this integral here into a double sum, and you do integrals over all those W's. The density matrix has exactly the same form as this does. You can go through the manipulations that I did here in that case, but I've already gone through the manipulation. So I'm simply going to write it down, what the density matrix is. We really want d rho dt. And that's equal to minus lambda over 2, the integral over all space, and twice, of A of x t, I only need one of these things. Dx prime, A of x prime t, commutator A, of x prime t, rho of t, and similarly, this is equal to minus lambda of 2 in x prime a squared of x prime t, rho of t plus a squared x prime t, rho of t, minus 2 a of x prime t, rho a of x prime t, rho. I'm writing all this out in such great detail because we're going to be actually working with that. Now, the theory isn't quite yet specified. I've specified mass density, but I haven't specified the sizes of the two parameters that are in this model. The lambda, whose dimensions is in fact 1 over time in this case, it is a rate, and the size A, the size of these little spheres. And the numerical values that I'm going to choose are values that were suggested in a prior model by Girardi, Romini, and Weber. They call it their spontaneous localization model. And when I realized that what I had been doing, I had had certain problems, and their model resolved those problems for me in homage to what they had been doing, I called this a continuous spontaneous localization model. And it's worthwhile for me to show you a little bit of what the GRW spontaneous, Girardi, Romini, Weber, their spontaneous localization model is, because it's conceptually a very pretty model. It also explains the parameters, gives numerical values for the parameters here. The parameters in this model will be the same as the parameters in my model that I'm choosing here. The A will be mesoscopic distance, 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, and lambda will be 10 to the minus 16 inverse seconds. So the inverse of lambda, which is 10 to the 16 seconds, or 300 million years, will turn out, as you'll see, to be the collapse time for a single proton. I had a formulation of collapse models for more than a decade. It was not this very simple and beautiful one. It was a different one, and it was described in a different way, stochastic differential equations. But I was stumped. I was stuck because there were two problems I had. One was that I knew there ought to be collapsed position eigenstates because things are different in position. I felt that that was a very obvious thing. But the problem with collapsed position eigenstates is if something's in a position eigenstate, it has infinite energy. Its variance energy is infinite. And so how could you have collapsed position eigenstates to you know, a particle right there? You couldn't do that. You'd violate experiment. So I call that the preferred basis problem. The problem is, what basis should the collapse be to? Position eigenstates wouldn't seem to work, as far as I can see. The second problem I called the trigger problem. I didn't know what I described collapse. I would have a coupling constant, essentially the lambda here, which I would say, well, it has to be small for superposition of electrons in two places, because if it was large, if there was a rapid collapse rate for an electron in superposition in two places, then people wouldn't be able to do interference experiments with electrons, and I know there are interference experiments with electrons that are done. So it has to be small for microscopic objects, but on the other hand, for a large object, when you have an experiment and something's macroscopically different about the experiment, so you can read out what the differences, what the possible differences are, quantum mechanics gives you a superposition, a pointer here plus pointer there. I'm just thinking of it that way, but various other ways, you know, a printer can type one number or type another number depending upon the outcome, all macroscopically different outcomes. So I knew that the collapse rate for that had to be very fast, because otherwise the theory isn't doing what it's supposed to do. What it's supposed to do is see a superposition like that, and very rapidly, much faster than mental perception time, immediately collapse the state vector. And I could not figure out. I knew it was wrong to have a coupling constant there, which I turned on by hand, making it small for a microscopic system and large for a macroscopically different system. But I didn't know how to handle an equation which would be independent of me turning it on and off. And Girardi, Romini, and Weber solved both of these problems. They didn't do it with a modified Schrodinger equation. And there's another important problem with the theory. It violates the symmetry of wave functions, which this does not. The evolution destroys the symmetry of wave functions, or anti-symmetry of wave functions. But they solved these two problems. And they solved them in a very beautiful and elegant way. So let me describe the Girardi, Romini, Weber model. I'm going to do it very simply. Suppose you have a wave function. I'll make it real, so at an instant of time, and this is versus x, and it looks, I don't know, something like this, some kind of wave looking like that. The Girardi, Romini, and Weber, essentially what they did was they converted the wave function sudden collapse postulate into a dynamical statement. They said that, let's say the Hamiltonian is zero, so the wave function wouldn't change at all with time if it wasn't for the the spontaneous localization process here that they introduced. They say, introduce a parameter lambda, collapse time, and they say with probability 1 minus lambda dt over the next, let's say we're talking of time t, this is what the wave function looks like, over the next time interval dt, the wave function doesn't change. So it's very close to not changing. That is, the wave function is just this psi of x. But with probability lambda dt, there is what they call the spontaneous localization that has 9 syllables, and I decided to call it a hit. And what a hit is when something multiplies the wave function. And the thing that multiplies the wave function is a Gaussian, and it's a width A. And the reason they chose a finite width and not zero width is because if they made it zero width, in other words, a delta function, you would end up with a wave function, and you're multiplying the wave function, remember, by this Gaussian. So, let me color it short. A little teeny piece of color chalk here. So that after you multiply the wave function by the Gaussian, what do you end up with? You end up with something that looks something like this. I'm going to have a scaling it right, but something like that. In other words, only the bit of the wave function that's inside this Gaussian and the center of the Gaussian, for a moment I'll tell you about the hit. This is a hit. So I'm just crossing my H's. This is a hit. The wave function changes with probably lambda dt. It changes into psi of x multiplied by a Gaussian e to the minus x minus z squared over 2a squared, and for technical reasons I'll divide by pi a squared to the 1/4 power. So this is the hit wave function. And if it was a delta function, then you just get a little spike, and that's an eigenstate of this. Well, it's not a spike there, you have a spike right in the middle here, if this was a delta function. Spike right here, A was zero, and that would be a position eigenstate, and that would have too much energy. So the cleverness of them was to introduce a width, a parameter of the theory, a width A, so that that wouldn't happen. And they chose A to be 10 to the minus 2 centimeters, so it's very, very large for, let's say, for an atom wave function, atomic wave function. So if the atomic wave function is hit, it won't get too much energy at all. However, it will get some energy, because the wave function will be narrowed. And it will, if an electron, for example, in the ground state of hydrogen gets hit by one of these Gaussians, it's no longer the ground state wave function. It's slightly different. And the slightly different wave function can be written as the sum of the ground state wave function with a coefficient that's almost but not quite 1, plus the sum of all the other wave functions, including excited states of hydrogen, as well as the electron completely knocked out. In other words, this hitting process convert, because it narrows wave functions by the uncertainty principle, it converts, it gives energy to the particles that are hit. And so you get a prediction from this, as well as from CSL, and that's going to be one of the experimental tests, you get prediction that of spontaneous excitation. By spontaneous, it really means collapse-induced excitation, that an atom, electron and atom, occasionally could be knocked out of the atom because of this process, and that's an experimental test which I'll discuss. So this occurs with probability lambda dt, but what about the z's? What about the location of the hit? And this was the second very clever thing that Girardi, Romiti, and Wehner did. They said that the probability of a hit, so there's two stochastic processes here. First of all, the one is the probability that there will not be a hit. Given the conditional probability that there is a hit, what's the probability of a given z? The probability of a hit with a given z and z plus dz is defined as the norm of the wave function after the hit, but before renormalization. Because after all, once there's a hit, and you want to go back to a normalized wave function, you just divide by the square norm, and you get a unity one normalized wave function. That's how you get a new wave function to replace the old one. And so this is a process. It's not a modified Schrodinger equation. That's one of the nice things about CSL. It's a process that kind of goes alongside the Hamiltonian evolution, but this is the probability of a hit, and it's equal to just the square of this. And in a moment I'll explain why this is so clever. No, 2a squared, a squared, divided by pi a squared to the 1/2, and there's a dz over here. You can integrate this over z. You can see the integral probability is 1 about where it's going to be, because when you integrate over dz, this is the normalized Gaussian, so that becomes just 1, and then the integral of psi of x squared over all space is 1, and so the integrated probability is 1. What's so clever about this is if there is a hit way out here, it has a small probability, because the probability is proportional to the square of the wave function, the product of this with this after the hit but before normalization. So it's this thing squared. So if the hit occurs in the region where the wave, the hits are more likely to occur in the region where the wave function is big, and they're completely unlikely to occur in the place where the wave function is zero. And so, I mean, if you thought of putting in a process of hitting, you might think, well, I'll just make it random over all space, but that most of the hits would be out near infinity somewhere, and they wouldn't do anything. And so this makes it most likely for a hit to occur where the particle is. So this is the major idea of the Girardi, Rimini, and Weber. And this is how they solved my preferred basis problem. Yes, it's collapsed to position eigenstates, but no, it's not collapsed to exactly position eigenstates. Yeah.
This model with the wave function having both its position, like its options for position reduced, and its energy getting a kick, looks exactly like a measurement to me.
You can think of it as a measurement.
Can we talk about a spontaneous measurement theory?
You could if you want. In a sense, a collapse, well, if you limit yourself to measurement situations, and you have, well, it would really be a measurement to you if there was, let's say, if the wave function looked something like this, and then the hit was either here,
yeah,
or over there, and you'd end up with this particles here or particles there. This is, you know, this is more continuous set of options. But you can call it whatever you like. It's a good observation to make. Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever you mentioned, that this model has some other problems, but yeah, one of them seems to be that over time you'd have a net increase of energy of the universe.
Yes, you would.
Would that be measurable in a...
Yes. That is one of the tests, both the GRW and also this. It is, well, we'll actually come out with some numbers for CSL anyway about how much energy a proton will get. I think it's something like 10 to the minus 25th electron volts per second. But over the age of the universe, that can amount to the order of some degrees. And the thing that happens there is that let's say it's even the size of an electron volt. There's very little coupling between the, what's going to happen is the 3-degree body, black body radiation is essentially going to suck that energy out, and it's not going to change it very much, because there's so much more black body radiation, so to speak, than there is energy, numbers of particles. But also, the coupling is kind of weak. So those particles could, in fact, be sitting out there with somewhat greater energy than they might have otherwise have had, because the thermalization of them with the black body radiation is not that great. And I once spoke to Dennis Yama about this, and he said that people don't really know what the velocity of molecules out there in space is.
But what about a macroscopic object that we have in our hand, like, say, an apple?
Yes.
Would you be able to measure
it? No, well, think about this. 10 to the minus 25th electron volts per second. So if you have an apple, 10 to the 25th nucleons, something like that, that would be 1 electron volt per second. Volumetric measurements, but that's distributed, among all of the particles. So yes, you're heating it up. Volumetric measurements are not, that's another possible experimental test of this. They're nowhere near capable of measuring that rate of energy increase. These numbers, the lambda and the a, are quite cleverly chosen so that these kinds of experiments, well, another way of looking at this, which is something which I've done, is I have over the years made lambda versus a graphs
And the GRW point here of the values they chose, and as experiments come on along, parts of this graph are made no-nos and things like that, but that point lies within the experimental realm so far. But in fact, the mass proportionality of the CSL thing that I'm talking about, that is very accessible to experiment. Indeed, at the beginning, who knew whether particles, electrons, and nucleons would have the same collapse rate? So we gave them all the same collapse rate. And then I realized that you could do an experiment to distinguish, find the collapse rate, in particular the excitation of electrons. And then, most recently, a few years ago, I'll talk about it, the excitation of nuclei. And it looks like the evidence is very, very close to saying you can't have anything but mass proportionality, or you'll, or the theory will disagree with the experiment. So that's actually, the experiment is, in that respect, is testable. It's not testable yet against quantum mechanics, but it is internally testable. The parameters have to be set, and the mass proportionality, I've already biased this by telling you that. So thank you. So, okay, let me just say one other thing about the GRW cleverness here. It is this. The idea is that this is one part of how the hitting process works. And the collapse rate for a hit for a single nucleon would be quite small. It would take 10 to the 16 seconds, 300 million years per collapse, so it doesn't matter much. But what about for a pointer, which is in a superposition of being pointing this way plus pointing that way? Okay? Well, their statement was that each of the hitting process is independent for each particle. So let's call this that particular nucleon over there Alphonse, and the superposition of, well, you can think of the state vector as the direct product of all the, I mean, that's a simplified model for a pointer, but at any rate, direct product of all of the wave functions for all the independent particles, this is the simplest way of thinking about it, plus direct product of the wave of the state vectors for all the independent particles over here with some coefficients. And the point is, one hit will collapse the whole wave function. Why? Because if there's a hit on Alphonse, which looks like, whose wave function itself looks like this, and there's a hit over here, the tail of the Gaussian wipes out Alphonse over here. But it's wiping out Alphonse, which is multiplied by the wave function of all the other particles, and so it wipes out the whole amplitude of this. So one hit, bam, over here, will collapse the whole wave function. And so the collapse rate, because there are capital N particles and they're each independent, instead of the collapse rate being lambda, it's lambda times the number of particles that are there. Yes?
What's to stop in that situation, or just horribly improbable, that you get a hit on both particles on alpha and then the other one at the same time?
The theory says you get there's a certain probability for a hit. You can't get a hit at the same time. In other words, in DT, that would be a probability of the DT squared. And that would be negligible. It decides I'm going to hit a particle, and then it decides what hit it's going to make, where it's going to position its z, and that's it. And those are the measurable events that take place. Okay, so you can see where the lambda and the a came from. And now I'm going to go back to CSL. But you can see what happens here. If there's a hit on one particle, and if this wave function was the wave function I should have written down, an anti-symmetrized wave function, the wave function is no longer anti-symmetrized. And so this violates the Fermi-Dirac statistics in a bad way, but this does not. So we're going to come back after having done that, we're going to come back to CSL, and we're now going to draw the consequences of CSL for three different classes of experiments. One is interference experiments. One is spontaneous excitation experiments, giving particles energy where quantum theory says they wouldn't.
And the third one, if I have time, is briefly discussed as random walk. Little objects will jiggle for its quantum, in a way that quantum theory says they wouldn't jiggle. Quantum theory does say they would jiggle, but much less than this theory says. So in order to do this, I want to where's my equation for d rho and t? Okay, here it is, right over here. I want to actually calculate that. We can plug in for the a's what they are, the expression up here, and for simplicity, and all my applications, I'm just going to set h equals to 0. So we won't have to worry about that. So the a's just depend upon the position. And let me show you how this works. Suppose I want to calculate in the position basis. So if I have a bunch of particles, x1 to xn is the position basis, and I'm just going to call that x. Short hand notation. So ddt x rho of t x prime is what I want to calculate. And the first thing that I encounter is this term over here. When I show you how that works, you'll see how the whole rest of the terms work. So I get a minus lambda over 2, the integral of, I better change it to dx1 so I don't get confused. And now I want to put in my a squared and my rho, and my a squared is 1 over pi a squared to the 3/4 z minus x minus z squared over 2 a squared. Let's just suppose I'm just talking about protons. So the m of z over m zero is just this zeta dagger of z zeta of z, because the mass cancels. And then I have another one of these things, the integral of dz prime e to the minus x minus z prime squared over 2a squared zeta dagger of z prime zeta of z prime, and here's one. T, and then there's the other terms as well. And I have here x. And I'm going to slide it by here. So what does this do to an x? Well, we take the Hermitian conjugate. The Hermitian conjugate, this is the same. So we have a zeta. We have to worry what zeta dagger of z, zeta of z does to x. And what it does to x is it gives you well, you can write x is zeta dagger of x1, one particle's at x1, zeta dagger of x2, et cetera, times the vacuum. These create particles at positions x1, x2. And what this does is it commutes with each one of these and gives a delta function as it goes along. And then the zeta dagger just gives you back the original wave function. So you get the sum over all the particles from 1 to n of delta of z minus xi, where these are the locations of where the particle is. And if you think about it, that is the density if the particles are exactly at those points, because that's what the position eigenstate is. It has the particles exactly at those points. The delta function is the density. So we can, this x1, I should make this x1, I should make this x1. So here's with the x here. So I can do two things here. I can integrate over x1 here. And I can let my operators act on these position eigenstates. And let's see what you get from this. When I integrate over x1, this is, again, that problem one I gave you. The result is the difference of the z's squared divided by the sum of the variances squared. So and the 1 over pi a squared to the 3/4 all nicely canceled away. So I have the integral of dz and dz prime of e to the minus z prime squared over 4 a squared. And when this operates on the x, what I get is the sum over I equals 1 to n of delta of z minus xi. This is summing over all the partial positions. And the x then goes on through. This is an eigenstate of these operators. And then this operates on it. And so you get a delta of z minus x. Well, I better use another index here, xj, x minus j. And then the x goes on through. And in fact, it just gets multiplying the row of t. And now I can just do the integral when we have delta functions, you are laughing. A friend of mine liked to say. And you get the sum over I and j of e to the minus xi minus xj squared over 4a squared x rho. So this is a pretty simple thing. And we can now erase it for this one. It goes similarly. Oh dear. It goes similarly for the other terms. And so what you finally end up with is d rho of t dt equals the sum over I and j, the double sum, of e to the minus xi minus xj squared over 4a squared plus e to the minus xi prime minus xj prime squared over 4a squared minus 2 e to the minus xi minus xj prime squared over 4a squared x rho of t x prime. And that's the thing that we're going to use for all our calculations. All these x's are on the left here. All the x primes are on the right. And this is the term which has the mixed x and x prime indices over here. Okay. You can do other things with this, but let me first point out this is d rho dt equals something which doesn't depend upon t times prime rho prime. So the solution of this as a function of time is that rho of t is equal to e to the ct rho of 0. So you can just see how the later density matrix depends upon the earlier density matrix. You can also, now that we've done this, you can realize that since x I acting on x is equal to xi times x. In fact, you can slide these x's right outside and then completely, sorry. You can slide the x's completely outside and just get an expression for the density matrix itself where it's d rho of t dt, where these are the operators on the locations of those particles, of those kinds of particles that are the subject. You can do that. Okay, so now we've got the result, a lot of work. Let's now go ahead and start applying to various situations. And the first set of situations I'm going to apply to are collapse situations when you have a superposition of something in two places. We'll start out with a single particle. We'll then go to a little cluster of n particles, which are, however, whose size is quite small compared to this 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, and then we'll finally go to an extended object. And all of these have applications. That is, people have done experiments or are contemplating experiments for all of these. So the first thing is, let's talk about one particle. So let's say that the initial state vector is equal to, physically, you have a particle, superposition of a particle here plus a particle there. So alpha 1, state 1 plus alpha 2, state 2, where 1 is, this is space, a particle here and nothing there. And state 2 corresponds to nothing here and a particle over there. And with time, what's going to happen to this? If this particle will be one proton, what's going to happen to it? Well, first of all, it's one particle. So in this particular case, d rho of t dt, I'm going to use the operator formulation, Well, there is only one particle, so this would be x minus x squared, that's the number 1. This is x minus x squared, that's the number 1. So this is 2 minus 2, and so we have minus lambda over 2 times 2. Got my minus lambda over 2 here. Okay. Minus lambda over 2 times 2 times 1 minus e to the minus the operator x minus the operator x prime, x minus x prime squared over 4a squared times rho of t. Okay. Maybe I should call this x left and call this x right, because these x's up act to the left of this, and these x's act to the right of that. Okay. So now let's look at the off-diagonal elements of this. And so let's see what dvt of rho of t is between the states 1 and 2. And that's equal to minus lambda times 1 minus. And now, the 1 is x, 1 rho of t 2 minus 1 e to the minus xl minus xr squared over 4 a squared rho of t 2. Now the thing here is that I'm assuming that the wave functions themselves are small compared to A, so the size is very much less than A, as it would be appropriate for a small particle, but also that the distance between them is very much greater than A. Distance very much greater than 10 to the minus 5 centimeters in this case, to make this calculation simple. And what happens? XL, acting on state 1, gives you a number somewhere around here. XR, acting on 2, gives you numbers somewhere around here. The difference of those numbers, I really should put in an x here, and then an x, and then integrate over all x, but the point is all those x's will be in this region, and all these x's will be in that region, and the difference of these numbers squared is very much bigger than a squared, which means that this is essentially 0. So the result is that this is equal to simply minus lambda 1 rho of t 2. And so the off-diagonal matrix elements decay exponentially, e to the minus lambda t acting on the initial state, which is alpha 1, alpha 2 complex conjugate, the off-diagonal element. So that you can see that lambda is the collapse rate for this single particle. Now, Anton Zeilinger in late 80s did an experiment of neutron interference. He put essentially a neutron through two slits. So you have the wave packet for the neutron coming to the slits and splitting into two pieces. And you have exactly the situation that's over here. The two pieces, until they recombine, will be described by this. And so for the amount of time that it takes to perform the experiment was around 200 hundredths of a second, these two packets play this gambler's ruin game. One of them gets smaller amplitude, the other one gets a larger amplitude. So when they come together, the contrast of the interference pattern is not as great as it would be if this process hadn't been taking place. And Anton did a beautiful experiment. He got a very nice prediction in agreement with what quantum mechanics would predict to a 1% accuracy. And if you you put in the numbers, which is lambda t approximately equal to 100 hundredth, if he could detect if lambda inverse greater than equal to 100 times t, and t was 2 hundredths of a second, so greater than 2 seconds. Now lambda inverse is chosen by GRW to be 300 million years, so there's some distance to go. There's a way to go here. And indeed, Anton went some distance in this direction. He fairly recently did an experiment with a buckyball, carbon 60, which has 720 nucleons inside of it. And so let's see if what would happen if the superposition was not one particle, but was n particles here plus n particles there. Again, it's a two-slit interference experiment. So then what do we do? The buckyball particles are quite small compared to A. So we have on the left-hand side of this equation, xi and xj being on the left, this distance is very small compared to A. This is essentially the number 1. And this is on the right, that's essentially the number 1. And we have the sum over I and j over all the particles twice. So for summing over j, you get n. And summing over I, you get another factor of n. So this is equal to minus lambda over 2 times n squared plus n squared plus or minus 0, because this term over here, the x's correspond to the buckyball that went through this slit, and the x primes correspond to the buckyball that went through the other slit, and so you get minus lambda n squared as the collapse rate. And so we have this, or lambda inverse experiment, which will test this. And if you put in the number 720 for the number for n equals 720, and the time of the experiment was about 500 seconds, you get lambda inverse is greater than or equal to 2.5 times 10 to the 6 seconds, and that's a big improvement, factor of 10 to the 6. Of course, again, the number chosen by GRW is 10 to the 16th, so another 20 years, n time will improve that by a factor of 6, 10 to the 6, another 20 years, another factor of 10 to the 6, and only 40 years, we should have a test.
Is that Murphy's Law for Anton's experiment?
We hope.
In the last year, he's done a better experiment, not with carbon 60, but with some C72. No, some molecule which doesn't have the symmetry.
So it's the point here is it's larger number and it's the time longer. That's the crucial thing. But I would have heard from him if he was anywhere near this.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, between the two experiments, I mean, was the accuracy the same as compared to?
Yes, roughly 1% accuracy.
Still,
yeah,
1%.
Yeah, roughly 1% accuracy. So I'm making, it probably was somewhat different, but for simplicity, I'm showing you. This is the ballpark that we're nowhere near testing the theory. Okay, now, what about an overlapping, an object which is macroscopic, and such as superposition of something here plus something there, and the two overlap or don't overlap, depending upon whether they overlap or not. Now, that's a important consideration, because there is an experiment that hasn't been done yet, but it's been proposed, which was proposed by Roger Penrose. And that experiment, there's a recent FISREV letter about it, the idea is to have a mirror which can move. So it can be on the edge of a cantilever, for example. And a mirror here, which is fixed. And shine in a photon at a beam splitter, and so with 50% chance, it goes up and hits the mirror here, and the mirror, because of the impact, and reflects, but because of the impact, the mirror moves up, and 50% chance, it goes this way and hits this mirror doesn't move at all, and of course, then the photon here comes back and goes down, and the photon here comes back and goes down, and then you interfere the photon. The superposition that you get is essentially 1 over the square root of 2. The mirror over here, well, the mirror's over here, and the photon didn't hit it. The photon went like this. There to there, and back down, plus 1 over the square root of 2, the mirror is displaced. This is the line of it. The mirror is displaced up because the photon came in, hit the mirror, and went down like this. So what we do have is a superposition of the mirror and itself displaced from itself. So you have a superposition of two states of different mass density. Where they don't overlap up here and down there, there's a different mass density. And so collapse will start to take place. So these amplitudes will no longer be 1 over the square root of 2 for a given collapse scenario. This might get a little bit bigger, this might get a little bit smaller, and when you have all the possibilities, you're going to get a little bit of a washout of the interference pattern. Okay. Now I see that time is crowding in on me, so I'm going to just give you the formula, which, however, you could use as an exercise, but I would have to kind of guide you through it. So, well, it's not so hard. I'll just at least give you the idea. Suppose you have some kind of an object, and you have the object displaced from itself. Same object here. Okay. Think of dividing the volume into little cells of volume A cubed. So the little A size volumes, like this. Okay. And in performing this sum, think of when the X's are in the same cell, the positions of the particles in the same cell, and how many particles in there. Well, if D is the number of particles unit volume, then there's dA cubed particles in that cell. And suppose that it is not quite true, but if something's in this cell and any other cell, well, if there are many A's, certainly it's true. If they close, it's not quite true, but that's all right. Then the X's, you get 0. And so in the region in which there's so what does the sum give you? Okay. Well, you're summing over I and J, the particles that are in the cell. You get dA cubed to those particles, and you get dA cubed of the I particles and of the J particles, and so it's this thing squared, and the number of cells there are is V over A cubed. But you have to, you overcount it. Well, what this term gives you is 0 if the I's are here and the J's are there. But if the I's and J's are inside of here, in this region over here, they, which I'll call the V0 here, these things are volume V, then you get a contribution from here. You get the same contribution. There's a 2 here because there's 2 of these terms, whether they're the left or the right. And you get a d a cubed squared times v0 over a cubed, where v0 is the volume inside. And so you end up with 1 rho of t 2 is equal to e to the minus lambda t dA cubed times dV minus V0. In other words, it's if V0 is equal to V, there's no collapse rate. That is, if this is these all overlap each other. If V0 is 0, but they're completely apart from each other, the collapse rate is dA cubed times dV, which is the number of particles that are in there. So it's the number of particles when they're completely apart. It's the number of particles that are in there times the number of particles in a cell. it's not n squared, because they're large objects. It's instead that times the number of particles in the cell. And if there's some overlap, you get a lesser lapse rate. And you can work this out for the proposal of over here of Pedro's, and just you get, for the proposed experiment, which they thought was practical, you get lambda inverse is greater than or equal to 10 to the 10th seconds. Still far from the, I think it is 10 to the 10th seconds. It's still far from, that's the best they could do, still far from the 10 to the 16th proposed by Girardi and Meaningly. So anyway, you see that this collapse rate has, for this class of experiments, predictable consequences. The next class of experiments I want to talk about is energy production. Okay? And I think I'm not going to be able to go through all the mathematics here, but it certainly can be done. But I'll just give you the idea and I'll give you the results. To calculate the change of the expectation value of the energy when you have n particles and pn squared over 2m plus the potential energy is the Hamiltonian, you want to calculate ddt of the trace of h times rho. And since we have rho, we have a perfectly good expression here for rho, we can calculate this. Where you're taking the trace, which means that you can go in any representation you want to, and so the thing to do is this, that's the trace, and h in the position representation, you know, these are second derivatives, minus h bar squared over 2m and v squared to the x squared, v commutes with this because it's just a function of position. So when you set x prime equal to x, that is the right-hand side is x and the left is x, when this is equal to this, well, this term completely cancels that. So v makes no contribution at all. And you get an exact expression if you work through the derivatives. You just have to take the derivatives. It turns out, it's a little subtle thing, that the derivatives with respect to these x's here, you take the derivatives of all the terms except the ones for which x, j, I, and j are the same, because that's there's no derivative of that. But here, x and x prime, when j is equal to I, you take the derivative with respect to xi, you not take the derivative with respect to xj prime, so you do get that derivative. So these two derivatives of these two terms are canceled by the derivative of these terms, except for the specific terms where j is equal to I. And then you can do the derivatives, and it just brings down the number. And the result is that you get 3/4 lambda h bar squared over m a squared n. So what it is that each of the particles itself, even though they may be bound together in a very complicated way or something like that, each of the particles acts as if it's given energy itself, just by itself, independently of the others. And the h bar over a is the momentum kick that it gets. And there you are. The energy increases. The mean energy increases linearly with time. The rho doesn't appear on the right-hand side because you end up with the trace of rho. That's a number, and the trace of rho is just one. So there is this energy increase, which we talked about earlier, that it's you put in the numbers. For a nucleon, it's 6 times 10 to the minus 44 dH bar dt, 6 joules per second, equals 4 times 10 to the minus 25th electrons per second. Okay, now that's a very small amount. We can't detect that. But that's the bad news. But the good news is that while that's the average behavior, individual particles can get quite a kick. And in particular, there's an experiment by Frank Avignoni, which has been going on for decades. and it just gets better and better, but he's doing different things each time. And what he does is he has in a mine a slab of germanium, and he has it in a Dewar flask, and he has a terminal here and a terminal here, and it's back-biased there are well-known germanium detectors for a particle for energy. So if, for some reason, something should happen in here, namely some energy should be generated in here, there'll be a pulse that comes out, and you can count the pulse, and the height of the pulse depends on the energy is proportional to the height of the pulse. So you can find out in various energy bins how much energy is generated in here. And there is a process which we looked at, which is double theta decay. And that was one of the sources, so he can account for that. Initially, there was some radioactive contaminants in here, and they would radioactively decay, and you would see them, but they decayed out over time. Right now, he's looking for WIMPs to collide with this little slug of germanium, and if one does, there'll be a huge energy pulse, hopefully, and then he'll say, I discovered a WIMP. As far as collapse is concerning, this is fine for us, because let's specifically look at, here's the germanium nucleus, and let's look at the 1s electron and the lowest energy, one of the two 1s electrons, the lowest energy state in germanium. And this is the one for which it's most spectacular what happens. If, as I said, the wave function is there, nice and symmetric, minding its own business, it's the ground state, and if you can think of it in terms of GRW hits, or you can think of it in terms of the CSL, little infinitesimal hits, the wave function shape is distorted, and that's equal to the ground state wave function plus some of the other wave functions, but all the other electrons are there, so the sum that remains is the electron getting kicked out. So the theory CSL predicts electrons will get kicked out at a certain rate. And so he would see that over there. And in fact, what would happen, or how would he see it? Well, what would happen is this. The electron gets kicked out, then there's a hole down here, and all the other electrons cascade down. And the binding energy of that 1s electron is 11.1 keV, and so the collection of photons that would come out would be 11.1 keV worth of photons. In addition, the electron that's moving over here would be colliding with atoms and causing radiation, and someone would get a pulse equal to the 11.1 keV. So you expect something like this, 11.1 keV versus energy, and here's 11.1. And we actually calculated, we did a Harpy-Fock calculation for this, a colleague and myself, and he actually did the hard work and did the calculation. I just cheered him on. It would look something, well, it goes all the way down to it, something like that. So you look for the signature of such an occurrence, and you don't see it. Let's just see if I put another thing here. Yeah. This is less than 0.05 counts per kilogram per day. He's looking at this thing for over about a year. And based upon that, one can put a restriction on the amount of excitation. And I don't have time to derive this equation, but it can be derived from the equations that are over here. Suppose that the I and J's particles aren't necessarily the same, that there are nucleons and electrons in there. You should have a GI and a GJ here. And if you then work out what this, you then expand this in a power series of xi minus xj squared over a squared. Now the matrix elements of xi minus xj squared over x, that's about the size squared of the object. If it's an atom, it's roughly 10 to minus 8 or smaller, squared divided for the 1s8, divided by a squared. So that's a good power series that converges very well. And the first term, it turns out that you only get contributions from the cross terms over here. The rest of the term goes away. And the matrix element looks just like the dipole excitation matrix element. And that is to say, I could just write the expression down for the rate of excitation. And the rate of excitation is lambda over 2a squared be some excited state, sum over I, GI, XI, where that's the operator for position. This is the ground state, that's the excited state, and sum over J, GJ, XJ, the alpha. So that's the probability of an excitation to that state from the ground state, and in this case it's a continuum, and you can look in continuum range and so forth and see what's happening there. Now, the interesting thing that I want to point out to you is that these are states which are eigenstates. I've gotten rid of the center of mass behavior. This is just the ground state itself. These are eigenstates of center of mass with eigenvalue 0. That is to say, E alpha and E 0 stand, you have MI, XI acting on one of these states, E 0 or E alpha, that's identically 0, because I've gotten rid of the independent center of mass behavior. So if the G's are proportional to the mass of the particles, this predicted rate is identically 0. What has to go to the next order, which is the quadrupole order, that is this squared, that is the size of the object divided by a to the fourth power, and that becomes very, very, very small. So you can see that if this is not equal, this is a good test of how close that comes. And let me just write out what gamma alpha is. It's lambda over 2 a squared times g minus little m over capital M squared times the absolute magnitude of E alpha sum over xi. Because of this, you can write the center mass part of the nucleon of the nucleons in terms of the center mass part of the electrons. And that's the reason for this. Sum of xi just over the electrons is 0, absolute magnitude squared. And so if the g for the electrons is in fact equal to the mass of the electrons divided by the mass of the proton, which is mass proportional coupling, this will be identically 0. You can put in the limits. And what we find is that for this experiment, this is less than or equal to 13 times the mass of the electron divided by the mass of the proton. So this is the current limit. And that's very suggestive of mass proportional coupling. There's a more recent experiment, a Canadian experiment, at the Sudbury Nuclear Reactor, where they think they're doing an experiment which shoots neutrinos at deuterium, and they see what the solar flux of neutrinos is. But we piggybacked off of that experiment. That is to say, yes, they have neutrinos hitting the deuterium, but they're also going to be inside that same tank, it's a 12-meter shell full of deuterium. There ought to be spontaneous excitation of deuterium. Deuterium is going to break apart. And that will produce neutrons, too. The neutrinos come in and produce, knock apart the deuterium, but also this process knocks apart the deuterium. So the remainder left over after the solar model is taken care of, and what they wrote the paper for, we say, well, that is CSL excitation, but there are big error limits on it. And similarly, what was obtained here is a limit on the neutron-proton mass difference. That is to say, the g of the neutron compared to the proton, it's equal to the mass of the neutron divided by the mass of the proton, plus or minus 4 times 10 to the minus 3. And that's 3 times the mass of the neutron proton difference. And so that's pretty close. Just if they do a more accurate experiment, one may be able to say that within experimental accuracy, the coupling constant for the neutron has to be the same as the coupling constant for the proton. Now, I'm very rapidly going to talk about the last experiment. I'm not going to talk about them in detail. A small sphere of 10 to the minus 5 centimeters size will undergo random walk because of the CSL collapse mechanism, and you can calculate that random walk. Let me just describe physically why it's happening. Suppose here's your sphere, and here's the center of mass wave function. Like the calculation that you do for homework, the center of mass wave function achieves an equilibrium size. for this, for a 10th of minus 5th centimeter sphere of 1 gram per cc density, the size is around 10 to the minus 7 centimeters, and it's achieved in around 6 tenths of a second. So very rapidly, that wave function comes to an equilibrium size. But just like the part of the problem which I didn't have you calculate, the center of that object actually undergoes a random walk. And the reason is, as we pointed out, let's look at that wave function here. It's undergoing simultaneous expansion, assuming it's spherical here, due to the Schrodinger revolution. But it's also undergoing collapse. And if you think of it in terms of hits, the collapse doesn't have to be in the center. The collapse could be off to the side here. So if the collapse is off to the side here, what that amounts to is the new wave function is really centered off here. Now, of course, it's not a hitting process. This is a CSL process, which is a slow, continuous process. So you can think of these little tiny hits. The center is jiggling because of, if you go ahead and go further in the problem than I ask you, instead of calculating problem 5, instead of calculating just A, calculate B, you'll see that the center is undergoing random walk. It's jiggling. And you can calculate the distance it will go due to this jiggling. And it's around 5 times t in days to the 3/2 power centimeters. Now, random walk usually goes as to the 1/2 power, and this is to the 3/2 power, 1. The reason for that is normal random walk is you have a jiggling force, but you also have damping, collisions with other molecules. This is undamped random walk, and that goes as t to the 3/2 power. For comparison purposes, delta Q of quantum mechanics is 5 times 10 to the minus 4 times t in days. Now, the problem with an experiment like this, taking a tiny sphere of 10 to the minus 5 centimeters and watching it suspended, put charge on and suspended like in the Milligan oil drop experiment, that's one way of doing it. Actually, we have a suggestion in terms of a pole trap, but it's the same kind of thing. How do you suspend it? And watch it jiggling around. The problem is that if a molecule hits it, all hell breaks loose because it'll give it a much larger impact, make it move much more rapidly than this little tiny, very slow CSL jiggling. So you need a very good vacuum. The best vacuum that I've been able to come across, but apparently it's not, there are other people who get vacuums like this. In 1990, so the technology must be better, is unbelievable 5 times 10 to the minus 17th torr. That means there's 100 molecules per cc. And if they move at, if the temperature is 4.2 degrees and they move at 5,000 centimeters per second, the mean collision time is 80 seconds. I'm sorry, 80 minutes. What am I saying? 80 seconds. 80 minutes. 80 minutes, which is a huge amount of time. In that amount of time, this would go about delta Q CSL would go about a millimeter, which is big enough, certainly big enough to see. Thermal radiation in there at the room temperature, it would the random walk through the radiation hitting it, jiggling it around. That would be it would swamp this. But it goes down as a very, very, with temperature very, very rapidly, I think the 5th power of temperature, and it's really negligible, like 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per day due to thermal radiation. The thing that makes it's interesting, illumination, if you want to see it, you've got to put a light on it. And it's illumination radiation that's your major limitation. Because when you shine light at a sphere, on average it'll bounce out symmetrically, but actually it won't. These are photons. Some will hit one side and some hit the other side, and it'll undergo a random walk. And so what you really have to do is keep it dark and then briefly observe it and see where it's gotten to and then turn the light off. I found no one to do this experiment so far. But if any of you are going to experimental physics and want to talk about it, you have to talk. So, okay, in the last 5 minutes I have here, I want to do what Ray asked me to do, which is to kind of summarize
the strengths and weaknesses of this and to trash all the other interpretations. So let me go back to what I said right in the beginning of my lectures here. What's wanted is a well-defined set of rules for what the real states of nature are and their probabilities. And that's the thing that has motivated me for decades, is I just perceived that quantum mechanics were just poorly defined. No one's, as far as the Copenhagen interpretation, no one's said, you apply it to a case of an experiment, but nobody defines what an experiment is. You collapse the wave function when the experiment is over, but who knows when the wave function is, when the experiment is over. No one says when the experiment is over. The whole structure seemed to me so sloppy that there were two evolutions, the Schrodinger evolution and the collapse evolution. I couldn't believe that it would be that way, and that was why I had worked with this for so long. This is a theory in which the physical states make, the statement is that to every fluctuating W of T, there corresponds a realizable state. This probability rule which gives you the probability of that state, and those states make sense. That is, they're not superpositions of macroscopic things. They are, each of those states, in a very short time, will describe the world around you. Is there any other interpretation which does something like this? I think the pilot wave theory does too, or sometimes called Bohmian mechanics. It has a well-defined set of rules and well-defined probabilities. I've never been very keen on that. One reason was, it may have changed now, but this is an experimentally verifiable theory. It's different from quantum mechanics, and I've spent all day talking to you about the experiments that could test it. And the pilot wave theory, until recent modifications, was not experimentally testable. Also, I just don't believe those little points are in there. That's a matter of religious faith. I just don't think those little points are there. And they behave in a funny way. I mean, you have a particle in a stationary state, a little point is stationary. I just don't believe that the electron is represented by a little point station. But that's religion, and really should have nothing to do with physics, except that it has everything to do with motivation for why you do what you do. Interestingly enough, these are very radical approaches. They change quantum mechanics. And the conservative approaches don't do so well. In my opinion, they don't do it. They're not satisfactory. The conservative approaches are those, the ensemble, where you keep the formalism the way it is, and you try to interpret your way out of the problem, or you try to come up with some mathematical structures which really lie within the formalism that somehow you hope you'll be able to utilize, like consistent histories or environmental decoherence. As far as the ensemble interpretation or the knowledge interpretation, they're really pragmatic. They don't describe nature. They describe a collection of experiments or what's in your head about experiments. And I just don't believe physics is about that. But they're not well-defined. People really, just like, it's the Copenhagen situation all over again. Yes, for any specific example, you can come up with a set of rules for how to handle it. And Bell, in his wonderful paper, which I suggested that you read, Against Measurement, he coined anachronism. Quantum mechanics is very good fact for all practical purposes. And that's not good enough for a physics theory for all practical purposes. And physics is about nature. It's not about engineering. Environmental decoherence and consistent histories. I asked you when those people come to give those lectures, say to them, here's a state vector, here's a Hamiltonian. It could be the state vector for the universe or for the local galactic cluster or whatever it is. Anyway, here it is. Okay, tell me, what are the real states of nature and what are the probabilities? Just what do you set of rules? And they don't have such things. Yes, if you give them this room with air and an apparatus, they'll tell you the air is the environment, and the apparatus is the system. The decoherence people will trace over the air molecules, and lo and behold, on the diagonal is approximately, and you don't have to come up with some kind of criteria, is approximately the real states. But if you just say, look, I mean, here it is, and CSL will do this. In a very short time, every W of T will give you a physically reasonable state, and will give you a sensible state, and will give you the probabilities of this. Similarly, for consistent histories, Adrian Kent has shown that there is no, so far, and I've been spending a lot of good people spending a lot of time on this, there's no family of consistent histories. There's many families of consistent histories, and no one's come up with a good set of rules for choosing one set over another that have not solved this problem. Given the initial state vector, given the Hamiltonian, for a serious part of the universe, just tell me, what are the real states? You can wait a while and then tell me, you can wait till, you know, 10 years or whatever, but tell me, eventually, what are the real states? So this is, I'm going to trash all the other interpretations. Let me just say, and I'll close this future research as far as CSL is concerned. I would like to have an experimental proof. Of course, experiment that distinguishes between this and quantum mechanics. I would like CSL to be vindicated and quantum mechanics to be not vindicated, and that would be very exciting because so far quantum mechanics has been amazing. No, nothing, no experiment has ever been unexplainable by the fat rules of quantum mechanics. I would like to have an identification of the fluctuating field with something physical. Right now it's phenomenological theory, a description of a process, but I would like to see that W of X and T, that field, arise in a natural way from, for example, metric fluctuations or something like that. As far as the relativistic version is concerned, I tried for a decade to come up with one. I've given up. My lecture yesterday was about a quasi-relativistic theory, that is one that I think would pass indeed all experimental tests so far, so it would be consistent with our experience of relativity, but in fact it isn't exactly relativistic. It really exists in one reference frame, which you might identify with the co-moving frame of the universe. This is fairly recent work, and so this is early on. And so there are certainly problems with this. It's not a theory. It's a model, but I think it, the model solves the measurement problem, which I prefer to call the reality problem. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Questions? Comments?
What's your geranium crystal? Oh, the geranium crystal experiment?
Yes.
Did you determine that the observed results are consistent with this theory?
The observed results are consistent with the theory, provided there is mass proportional coupling. If you say that the 10 to the minus 16, the rate of collapse of a proton is 10 to the minus 16 per second, for not only a proton but for an electron, it predicts much too much excitation of germanium. So you have to have the electrons excited less, and you don't yet have it completely confirmed, but it looks as if it's getting closer and closer to the coupling. The collapse rate has to be proportional, or the coupling has to be proportional to the mass of the particle. The collapse rate would actually be proportional to the ratio of the mass, because of two g's, products of g's, the mass of the electron divided by the mass of the proton squared. So the electrons have, if this is correct, way, way smaller collapse rate. If you have a superposition of many electrons here plus many electrons there, it'll take much longer than a bunch of nucleons here plus a bunch of nucleons there. So the theory predicts in that case you could actually do interference experiments with an electron wall somehow. Yeah?
I'd be interested in, this clearly explains how measurement would cause collapse in the case of measurement devices that have pointers. What about ones that don't have moving parts, for example, phosphorescent screen?
Yes, this was a suggestion early on by David Albert and Lev Leiden, that you could make a situation of a superposition of many photons hitting or not hitting the phosphorescent screen, and then you could see or not see, and because the particles aren't displaced in the phosphorescent screen by very much, and the electrons just move out and then irradiate, this, they said, would not cause collapse. Well, Giancarlo Girardi and a colleague who is biologically knowledgeable at the International Center in Theoretical Physics said, okay, now wait a minute, the measuring apparatus here is not only that screen, but the person who sees it.
If we have a detector, that's one thing, but just talk about seeing it or not seeing it. And then they did an analysis of the potassium pumps in the neurons of the brain, which, if it's excited, there's a displacement of potassium. They go outside of a membrane and then come back. If it's not excited, they don't. So you have a superposition of if you're talking about a person seeing things, you have a superposition of seeing plus not seeing, and that's enough, they argued by waving hands, to collapse the wave function. Something interesting here, for a fly, however, that's not the case. So if you take your hand like this, and depending upon the result of the experiment, you're going to whack a fly or not whack a fly, okay? So your superposition of the fly sitting there and you're not going to hit it, the superposition of fly sitting there, you are going to hit it. As soon as it hits, as your hand moves towards it, you know, flies, they jump. Then the fly is in a position of sitting there and not sitting there, that's enough mass displaced, so that you can collapse in this situation. Okay, so that, in other words, the lesson of this is you must consider the whole apparatus. There's an experiment that was done, proposed by Tony Leggett, which is coherent flux tunneling, which he was very concerned. He said there had never been an experiment where you have a superposition of really many particles. 10 to the 12th electrons circulating to the right in a squid, plus circulating to the left in a squid, and actually that's been set up. And the predictions of quantum mechanics are exactly predicted. But this theory says it should be predicted, because those electrons circulating to the right or the left, each of those states is the same mass density, because the electrons are in exactly the same place. I talked to Tony about it, he suggested the following thing. Suppose you suspended a magnet on a string above the circulating electrons. So if they circulate one way, the magnet is pulled down. If they circulate the other way, the magnet is pulled up. So that you then have a separation of a macroscopic object being in two different places, and then you should have collapse that has some effect on it. But no one's done that experiment.
So in the case of the phosphorescent screen, I'm satisfied that you have to consider your interaction with the system. It's sufficient that it gets collapsed by the brain. Would it get collapsed somewhere before the brain as well?
No, it wouldn't. Certainly not according to this theory. If it was a relativistic theory and you could talk instead of in terms of mass density but energy density, there would be a superposition of different energy density of the photons, you know, outside, but not. I don't think it would be enough to collapse the wave function.
I guess I'm thinking of the reaction of the eyes as opposed to brain proper.
Oh, in that case, definitely there would be a displacement. You know, you blink but they would just intend to have, I think the rods and cones, which the photons go into, the processes there do not involve a sufficient displacement of matter for the two states, and so that's why they seized on the potassium pumps to do that. But the point is that Albert and Biden said, we know that this is a macroscopic superposition. How come your theory doesn't predict collapse in that case? Well, how do you know it's a macroscopic superposition? How do they know it's a macroscopic? They don't know. You know when there's a result. Okay? So just their preconceptions are wrong. That's all.
So you're re-saying that it's when it goes in your brain that
for that particular situation, the superposition really exists. This encourages you to think of there really being something in space. When an electron goes through a two-slit experiment, you can think of there's really something. Actually, I have a whole description of this, mass density stuff, if you will, that's going through both slits. That's why it interferes. It's not because of like in the pilot wave model, this mysterious wave function goes through and guides the particles through. There really is stuff going through both of those slits, and that stuff is interfering. And why you see the electron in one place or another, that's because of the measurement you're making. It's not that has nothing to do with the process that goes on. It's very, I think it gives you very good insight into quantum behavior. I'm sorry, there's one, maybe we should have one last question.
So you say that it depends, the collapse depends on mass density, but do you have any candidates for the physical mechanism of why it collapses?
No, I don't. What you're asking is that the thing I said is the big, for me, a major open question. What is this W of T? It's the interaction of the W of T, of this fluctuating field with the mass density, that does it. And so if I knew what that fluctuating field was, I'd have embedded in another physical theory the cause of this collapse. But I so far do not have it. Oh, is it open?
Is there someone else coming in? It's about 5 minutes on this.
I don't think
before, but I don't want to hold people longer.
Does anybody from the I know if there's a seminar?
No, there is no.
I don't. So, is it okay if we? I mean, I don't want to.
Oh, we can keep people. Oh. Some students might have a class, so if you have to walk up, you might get no problem.
No. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Well, before you do that, let me just say, just keep your eyes posted on the website for what's coming in silence or maybe two. So just keep your eyes on the website.
And next week posted. Is reading week. So there will be no lecture the coming week.
And then the Tuesday is Anton's next following reading week. And so that'll be in the lecture theater. Tuesday.
It'll be March the 1st.
Yeah, that'll be Anton's lecture. It'll be in the lecture theater instead of in the fourth floor room.
Okay.
It's the first time math is starting to play a bigger role in any of the theories. You alluded to like a relative.
Yes.
Is there an analogy to like a Dirac type of equation or actually inklings of?
I probably don't know where my equations are here anymore. Let's see. No, it's not here. It's very simple to make a relativistic theory. I'll piggyback on this. If we get this, instead of just make this V4X, this is now a relativistic scalar. And this could be a quantum field. It could be psi bar psi. It has to be a quantum scalar. Or it could be just a single quantum field. And change this to a hypersurface. Arbitrary hypersurface and change this to an arbitrary hypersurface and make this an integral from one hypersurface to another, and you've got a relativistic theory and a big problem.
Relativistic and like sort of analogy.
Because it has the same form in all reference frames. That's what makes it relativistic theory. So the description is the same in all reference frames. In that sense, it's like Dirac's equation. The description is the same in all reference frames. But what it does is, it's really quite interesting. But physically, the bad thing that happens is this white noise has all wavelengths and frequencies in it. And if you have a classical function of time which interacts with a quantum system, if it has a frequency equal to the energy difference between, let's say, two states of that quantum system, it will excite it. This excites the vacuum. And in the vacuum, vacuum is the vacuum, let's say, for the existence of photons. That's the ground state, no particles there. But there is a first excited state where there's a proton, and it can have any energy and momentum. And since this has all energies and momenta, it excites all of them. And that gives you infinite energy per second per unit volume out of the vacuum. And strictly speaking, that problem has never been solved. That's the major problem of making relativistic collapses. I've tried various other things. I mean, something more complicated than this. But the bottom line is that does not agree with the experiment. There is not infinite energy per second unit volume coming out of the vacuum.
I guess more of what I was asking, yes. Does it give any inklings of resolving sort of gravity with
no, behavior? No, I can't say it. No, it doesn't. I was very excited to see that the experiments seem to force this mass proportionality on it. Because just as is in your mind, if collapse depends upon the mass density, what else in physics depends upon mass density is gravity. That suggests a connection between collapse and gravity. And Roger Penrose, for many decades, has been suggesting that there is a connection between collapse and gravity. He's given some arguments. But this essentially his lambda is proportional to g. And it's not just him. Someone did actually before him, but he's been pushing it fairly hard. But so far, what that connection could be, I do not know. But it's nice to have experiment pushing this. Okay, well, thanks very, very much. I really, really enjoyed talking with you.